and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're learning more about how innovation is helping people in the Arctic move forward in today's world. We'll be hearing from a number of innovators about projects underway, both here in Alaska and abroad. This event took place on May 12th at the Hilton Hotel and was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. Lisa Valsko, President and CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, provides the introduction.
Hello, welcome everyone. We're going to do a little test here. Hello, my name is Lisa Valsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's such a pleasure to have you all here. So this is a program we are talking about how cool is that, innovation in the Arctic. And with that, I would like to just start with our program. I'm not going to read the bios of each of our speakers so that we have more time for them at the podium here, except for our first speaker. I will read that one. The rest of the bios are all on your table, and you can read those. Our first speaker that I'm going to bring up to the podium is back by popular demand. You might have seen him here before. He is also my boss. And he is he has been running me around the last couple days, to my pleasure. And he is Norway's ambassador to the United States. He presented his credentials to the President Obama at the White House in 2013. Ambassador Kåre Aas' distinguished career with the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs began in 1983. He left his position in Oslo as political director in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to become the Norwegian ambassador to the United States. Prior to his assignment as political director, Ambassador Aas served as a Norwegian ambassador to the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan from 2008 to 2010. From 2003 to 2008, Ambassador Aas served as Director General, Department for Security Policy and the High North, and in that capacity, he had the bilateral relationship between Norway and the US, the Russian Federation, and the Central Asian Republic in his portfolio. And he chaired and or was the member of several international groups working on nuclear disarmament and international peacekeeping operations. As the folks in Petersburg, Alaska told him, his motto was, make lefse, not war. From 2005 to 2007, he also served as the Norwegian governor to the International Atomic Energy Agency. I'd like to present and bring to the podium Ambassador Kåre Aas.
Thank you, Lisa, and good afternoon. It's really cool to be here, and also on a very, very important topic. I must also say that it's really great to be back in Anchorage, and also to see very many familiar faces. And just to mention a few, Fran Olmer, good to see you here. Terje Birkedal, the president of Sons of Norway, good to have you here. And also Marit Kristiansen, who has been the president of Sons of Norway for many, many years, and many others in the room. I came down to Anchorage yesterday evening, and I attended the Arctic ministerial meeting up in Fairbanks. And I must say that that meeting, it was a good meeting. It was an atmosphere of cooperation, and I also think that the meeting resulted in good and productive decisions, which will be then implemented now in the 2 years to come under the Finnish chair of the Arctic Council. And Norway, during the 2 years, the United States chaired the Arctic Council. We have been working very, very closely with the administration on issues of importance to the United States, but indeed also important to Norway. So what I would like to do now is to give some sort of general remarks, which is important to my government in relation to the Arctic. As for Alaska, the Arctic is vitally important to my country. And why is that? Yes, 10% of the Norwegian population, they live north of the polar circle. 80% of Norwegian sea areas, they are north of the polar circle, and 30% of our land area is also north of the polar circle. So a bit different from the situation here in the United States. But what is important is, of course, that Alaska is the only Arctic state in the United States, and Norway and Alaska, I would say, we work very, very closely together. And so the Arctic is a key priority issue for my government. And the overall goal for what we are doing within the framework of the Arctic Council is really to ensure that the Arctic remains an area of peace, stability, and international cooperation. And I think that sort of that ambition was also, I would say, the main conclusion from the meeting among the foreign ministers yesterday in Fairbanks. And Norway, we really want, and I think together with all the Arctic nations, we want the Arctic to remain as it is today when it comes to stability and predictability. And I'm sure that, I hope at least, that will be the case. So what are the main priorities for my country related to the Arctic? One has to do with the climate and the ongoing climate changes, which we see globally. And we have heard several times that we see the impact of the climate changes on the two poles, the North Pole and the South Pole, first, even though we know also that they have global consequences. And that is why we think, my government thinks, that is very, very important that the climate changes have to be addressed within a sort of a global framework. And we were one of the first countries to ratify the Paris Agreement, and we really also want all the signatories to that treaty to remain part of the Paris Agreement. Secondly, I would say that we know that the Arctic is a region with a lot of resources. And one of the ambitions for my government now is really to try to make changing the present economic situation into what we call a blue economy. And we also know that developing and further sort of extracting the resources from the ocean provides a lot of opportunities for all the Arctic countries. So Norway, with my country, generates most of our wealth from the ocean. And just imagine that 70% of the value of our export come from the ocean-related activities. And fisheries is one of the important sectors which amounts to approximately 12% of our total exports of goods from Norway. And oil and gas, of course, you know that Norway is an exporter of oil and gas, and we have been that for many, many, many years now. And I would say that thanks to continuous innovation, we have a significant amount of experience in sustainably developing and managing some of the deepest and harshest ocean conditions in the world, including in the Arctic. And what has happened in my country, in Norway, is that we have gradually moved towards the Arctic when we started with offshore drilling back in the 1970s, and we are now, or the oil and gas companies, they are now operating in north of the Arctic Circle. We also see that maritime transport is another key sector for our economy, and 80% of the Arctic maritime traffic is indeed in the Norwegian Arctic. Another important growing industry is tourism, and we see now that tourism is not just during the summer months, but also all year round. And let me try to exemplify how Norway is working on the innovative part of our economy and related to the Arctic. Last February, the Norwegian government presented an ocean strategy, and the aim is to further develop and strengthen the Norwegian ocean economy based on our history, but also our comparative advantages. And there are three core elements in this strategy. The first one is to develop the best possible framework conditions for good and proper use of the ocean resources. And the second one is to facilitate more knowledge and technology development through a focus on research and innovation. And the last element is to ensure international cooperation and access to global markets. Let me also tell you that 2 months ago, the government also presented a white paper on Norway's industry policy, and that was the first paper which was now presented to the parliament. And the last time the government did that was back in 1981. And the whole idea with this new white paper is really to have a national debate on how Norway is going to transition from the sort of traditional oil and gas economy with some other sectors as part of our sort of broader economic situation into the sort of the new area and where, for example, digitalization is an important part in that and the technological shift. So the Norwegian government and private sector are instrumental in transforming Norway's petroleum economy to a more diversified and technological innovative economy. And on that note, we are looking into the need for better satellite information system in the Arctic waters. And we think that satellite technology plays an important role in Arctic areas and may enable innovation and development. We know that, for example, the infrastructure in the Arctic is different, at least in some parts of most parts of the Arctic, and that you need some sort of other means in order to make use of the digital instruments. And I think that we now have a Norwegian company called Telenor, and they operate satellites that provide broadband internet to the polar areas. Let me also say, and I will conclude with that, and that is that we are witnessing and we are experiencing a huge interest now from U.S. policy makers to learn, I would say, and to gain or to engage in a dialogue with Norway on Arctic issues. Just 3-4 weeks ago, there was a Congress delegation headed by Speaker Paul Ryan. He went to Norway. In 2 weeks' time, Senator Murkowski and the Secretary of Interior, together with other members of Congress, they will be visiting also Norway. And all of them, they go to the northern parts of Norway. And there are two reasons why they want to visit Norway. First of all, they want to discuss with us Norway as a neighbor to Russia. But the second part of it has indeed to do with how Norway has developed over Arctic areas. And I think that, and that's sort of probably my main message, that we have been able to sort of develop our economy. We have been able to strengthen our infrastructure in the north, while at the same time providing, or not just providing, but also taking into account on a sustainable way the environment. So the sustainable, the environmental dimension compared to economic development have been part of I will say, the success of Norway in the Arctic. So with those words, thank you for your attention. I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Aas. With that, I'd like to bring to the podium Mr. Martin Brugård from Innovation Norway.
Hi there. At first, I must say that it's an honor, but also really scary to speak after the ambassador, because I wasn't sure what he was going to say, so I might have to change what I was going to say. And the second part is, I was so glad that Lisa said that questions are in the end, because when we were up in Fairbanks on Tuesday, I do as I do in Norway and Scandinavia, I say, we'll do questions as I speak. But it turns out that you Americans are a bit more trigger happy on the questions than us Scandinavians, so that was not a good idea. But I'm gonna give you a brief input on the framework that we do, or that we have in Norway to foster entrepreneurship and innovation in the Arctic. But to do that, just so that you understand, these are my viewpoints. Some of them are my personal viewpoints, so just a bit about my background so you understand where I'm coming from. My name is Morten Brugård. I grew up in a small town in the southern parts of Norway. And now I moved to, many years ago, I moved to Vadsø, which is at the same, I never remember if it's longitude or latitude, but it's like Barrow. So now you get it. I did my bachelor's in economics and my master's in management, and then I moved to St. Petersburg, Russia, where I studied innovation and entrepreneurship at the Vyshnaya Skola Menedžmenta. So for me, the Arctic has always been the focus of my innovation viewpoints, how different countries do different things. And to give you a short introduction to Innovation Norway, Innovation Norway is Norway's main business development agency. We are located in 17 offices all around Norway. We are co-located with the embassy or the general consulates in, I think now, 34 countries across the world. And we're the one-stop shop for Norwegian businesses. If you have an idea, if you have a product, if you already have customers and you want to do internationalization of that opportunity that you see, we're there for you all the way. So that's what we do. And my personal viewpoints on innovation as a whole. We've been talking a lot about innovation down at the North by North at the museum today. And as a small town boy, for me, it's important to kind of dumb it down a bit. Because when I travel around the Arctic, you can't speak like you're some venture capitalist from Silicon Valley. When I sit in Vadsø or 5,000 people and they come there and say, yeah, you're going to have to do this and that, and I see that people are like, uh-uh, that's not going to happen. But for me, I grew up in the forestry industry. My father and I, we used to go, is it called logging or whatever? So when I think of innovation, the whole point is that all of us, we want to be better off tomorrow than we are today. And usually you add workers, you add input, you add different stuff to make growth. But you can also innovate to create growth. And it's not really hard. It's doing what you usually do, do it better, faster, smarter. For me, it was like if I chop down a tree faster or more efficient, got it out of the woods faster, then I could buy a new pickup truck faster. It's as easy as that. So that's my point. All the businesses in Norway, we focus on, you want to do the incremental steps. And if you do enough incremental steps, then you have disruption. You don't have to make it sound so researchy. I'm going to talk more about that afterwards. But just to give you an insight into northern parts of Norway. When I was young, I remember I read books about the Nazi Germans pulling out of northern Norway with the scorched earth tactics, where they burnt everything as they withdrew. So for me and for all of Norway, it was really, everything was burnt to the ground after World War II. There was nothing there. And growing up and thinking of the region as a whole as that, it was strange to move there. But after I finished my studies, I worked a bit, and then I moved there because I thought that the opportunities in the north were the biggest in Norway. And today, the northern parts of Norway are the engine of the economic growth in Norway. We have higher growth than any other region in the country. And we're a very prosperous region. And who would have thought that only 10, 20, 30 years ago? And how did we get there? We focused on continuous improvement, innovation, small incremental steps to make everything better day by day. And for Innovation Norway, about 10 to 15 years ago, we started focusing on stopping to have what you call here payroll support, I think. And we started focusing on, we only fund projects that are R&D focused. So we have to do something new. You can't just go ahead and do what you've always been doing, because that's never going to give you anything. And what I want to focus on is there are three points that Innovation Norway in the Arctic, in the northern parts of Norway, focuses on. The ambassador can take these home afterwards. We can call it the Brugard Doctrine or something. That would be cool. It's first, R&D. R&D needs to be more for the businesses. The businesses need to talk to the universities, and the universities need to talk to the businesses. It's too much silo now. One side is saying, yeah, we do this, and the others, yeah, we do that. But there's so much that could be done in the connectivity between businesses and universities, and both have to be a little bit humble about what they do. Because one side is saying they don't make money, and the other say they don't make research. But they both make a little bit of both. And then the second thing is we need to attract more competent capital. For those of you who watch House of Cards, they have a term there that's called the trickle-down economics. It's like that in Norway as well, but it doesn't trickle down to the people. It trickles from the north to the south. So what we need to focus on is to make the money from the north that's made in the north, stay in the north, and get reinvested in the north by the people who knows exactly what they're doing. And that's the important thing, a competent capital, not just capital. You can have friends, family, and fools fund you, but that's not going to get you anywhere. You're going to have people that worked in the business, did what you're going to do, and they're going to help you a lot with capital and with knowledge. And the third thing is cooperation. My example here, it's one of my favorite stories. Last year, I took 10 Norwegian oil and gas companies, or the suppliers to the oil and gas industry, to Houston, Texas. And we called Chevron, we called BP, we called everybody, and that opened the door. 10 companies walked in there, gave their 5-minute presentation. Not one of them would have been able to walk in that door without the other 9 with them. So the strength is in numbers. If you have 10 good companies, of course. And what we managed to do with these companies, I'm finishing off now, so I won't break off too much time here, is that one small town can't compete with another small town. They're both going to be competitors on the international market. So it's better to cooperate while you can and compete when you must. And I think that's an important lesson to bring along. So to sum it up, the three important things, R&D, businesses, and universities need to talk more. Competent capital, we need to have people with knowledge and capital able to put their money where their mouth is. And thirdly, cooperation. And I think if those three things can happen, the North is going to be the best. Yeah, and that's it, folks. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we are going to move over to some Alaskans who are doing some really cool things. And with that, I'd like to bring to the podium our first Alaskan who's doing really great things in Alaska. I've seen him speak a couple different places, Mr. Jack Herbert from the Cold Climate Housing Research Center.
Thank you so much. It's actually Hebert, not Herbert, but it happens all the time. And actually, following a couple of Vikings with my Irish and French blood is a little intimidating, by the way, especially big Vikings. How many of you are familiar with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center? Oh, gosh, thank God. That's wonderful. You know, we were founded now 18 years ago, and I see one of our co-founders and an amazing guy from Anchorage, Clay Porter, and a dear friend who was part of that effort. Now, this we are a private nonprofit. Again, we're not part of the University of Alaska, so we are a private not-for-profit business founded by people with a tool belt on to build a better home for Alaskans and the people of Alaska. For too many years, and you've all seen it, the technologies for the built environment that have been imported from elsewhere have just not worked and not been appropriate. And so it was out of that frustration that working builders took the step to drive the building science for the North. because the innovations that we're developing here and we were experimenting on with our clients were very creative and in most cases very appropriate. It was time for us to lead and not to follow. On the other hand, if we look at the amazing legacy of Alaska, you have the strongest people in the world here that were here long before those of us with Western blood showed up and were very, very successful. The other piece of that that I think is extremely important for us all to remember is that these folks that came decided this was a good place. They put roots down in this soil in this place that went right to the soul of the land and learned to live here and thrive here and develop great cultures here. And then the most restless people in the world, leaving wherever our ancestors came from. Mine came to Quebec in 1600, but nevertheless, they left somewhere. We come from a culture of leavers, not stayers, of restless people who were really never satisfied where we were. And we have come here to the top of the world together. We've created families together. We've created deep commitments to this place together. And so from the most rooted people in the world and the most restless people in the world, I expect and do believe that there will be great change in a positive way. We can't be afraid to try things. Our stock and our ancestors do not come from fear and small-mindedness. We come from a place of making change, seeing what the challenges are, and God knows there are lots of challenges in our world today. But from that strength of who we are as Alaskans, not Alaskants, we can get it done. We need to do it together as a family of first Alaskans and later Alaskans, of the stayers and the leavers. We need to work together, of Democrats and Republicans help us. We need to work together. We're Alaskans. And we can find the solutions. We need to remember what's precious, and that's this land and what it gives us, how it sustains us spiritually and physically, the bounty of this land, the food, the sky, the weather, the intensity of the weather, which makes us feel alive. We need to take care of that. The Housing Research Center's piece is just adequate shelter. Shelter that performs well and doesn't cripple a family economically, that provides jobs, that has good indoor air quality, that is aesthetic and not a cage, but something that we can build a family and grow in. And we need to really remember what home is. We're home builders, we say. We really build houses and we build shelter. We can't forget what home is. And home is this earth, this land, this place. And we can learn that from our indigenous brothers and sisters. They talked about shelter. It's just shelter. The home is the land. And we need to take care of it. We need to take care of each other. And we need to share our success with the world. Please keep an eye on what the Cold Climate Housing Research Center does. I've got amazing people around me, the founders, still working, still making a change. The young people that work with me at the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, incredibly creative, from all over the world. We have had Greenlandic folks work there. We've had Scandinavians there on sabbatical working with us to share our ideas. We work deeply with the Canadians. And we want to hear from you and your creative ideas, because we will find solutions for our children and grandchildren. My extended family, I've got 15 grandchildren. I'm taking my job pretty seriously. And we all need to. And thank you for a great lunch. We like to say it's water, food, and shelter. You did a good job on the water. The water was great, and the food today. And I'll keep working on the shelter. But keep in touch with us and come and visit us when you're in the Golden Heart City. And thanks.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from a number of innovators about Arctic projects underway here in Alaska and abroad in an event titled How Cool Is That? Innovation in the Arctic. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Hilton Hotel on May 12th. We return now to Lisa Falsko, President and CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council.
And our next person up to the podium might think that that food, water, shelter should also be food, water, shelter, art, and tradition. And with that, I'd like to bring up to the podium Ms. Holly Nordlum with Holly Nordlum Nenik Designs.
I was thinking, oh my gosh, I need my stool. thank you for inviting me, Lisa. I'm bringing a little brown to the table over there at the end. My name is Holly Mittetkok Nordlum, and I'm originally from Kotzebue, very far north, near Utqiagvik. I wanted to get up and say, it's not Barrow, it's Utqiagvik. I am a visual artist, a graphic artist, and I've done a lot of work for a lot of people here. And right now, I feel like I'm tippy-toeing, so if I'm shaking, it's because I'm on my very tippy-toes. Maybe. Yeah. Thank you.
You're
welcome. Right now, I'm working on a project bringing back traditional Inuit tattooing, and that is without machine, but with hand tattoos. And we're bringing back this project because I had been working in the arts for many, many years and calling out the issues in our communities, alcoholism, domestic violence, and such. Yeah, you probably know the statistics. And at some point, I realized that I needed something that wasn't just calling out the bad, but celebrating the good and help with healing. So we started this tattoo program, and my partner, who was originally living in Norway, she's from Greenland, is Maya Seoluk Jacobson, and now she's back in Denmark. And we've been working very hard to train traditional practitioners in the tattoo arts and educate our own people. With the tattoo project, we focus mostly on healing and identity with women and Native women, but also Native men. I guess the reason I was asked to come here today was to talk about the innovation and how we're incorporating innovation into something that is so traditional. Because Maya is in Denmark and travels to Greenland regularly, and I'm here in Alaska, and then we have partners in Nunavut that we've used the internet and constant communication of Skyping, FaceTiming, and Facebook, obviously, to communicate regularly and really to do our training. Even though Maya was here for a month, once she left, obviously, there was lots more training to do. And we've been working very hard to educate each other and do research into our own past. As part of the tattoo project, I received a Sundance Fellowship with the Sundance Institute in Utah. And so we started making a documentary film. And that film continues to be made about the struggles that we are having, but also the celebration and the healing that's taking place as we're tattooing. So thank you for your time, and I'm very honored to be here. Kuyanakpak.
And with that, I'd like to bring to the podium our next speaker, who is Ed Morris, and he has developed a product called Efficient. Ed, to the podium.
Thank you, Lise. Appreciate being here today. Before I continue, I'd like to say thank you and welcome our distinguished guests. Again, my name is Ed Morris. I'm the designer and inventor of the Efficient. I got a prototype on the back desk back here if you want to take a look at it later. It is a portable floating compact cleaning table to be used when you're processing your Efficient game. It also includes an anchor system that includes a snap-on for easy on and off on the table. Just a quick background why I did this. In 2015, there was a newscast, and it was talking about the upcoming season for the Kenai and Kasihelof dip netting season. And one of the major concerns was all the fish remains and the beach cleanup. So, and that was kind of a thought in 15, and then fast forward to 2017, they broadcast it again, and I thought, well, maybe somebody should build a floating table. And that's what I did. So, and this is when I put my pencil to paper, and then I designed it. Had the design done in February. Had the prototype done in April of this year. I'm planning on building another one for use for marketing purposes this summer. And I initially designed it to be deployed in three easy steps. So it's get out there, unsnap it, open it up, latch it, throw it in the water, and you're cleaning fish. So it's, and that's why it's called the Efficient, to help you get everything done quicker. And also, as I stated earlier too, I'll be conducting the market studies and surveys this summer to see if it's going to be commercially viable. And the benefits to the communities, using the Efficient, you'll be out in knee-deep water, possibly hip-deep water when you're using it, and that will encourage the users to discard of all the remains in the water. So that'll eliminate some of the problems for the cleanup. And then also processing your Efficient game in the water will help minimize riverbank and beach erosion too. And there is some problems with private landowners around with concerns about high traffic area. So this will minimize that impact too. So some of the benefits for the user, every time I saw the videos that they were showing on TV, everybody was always bending over. You know, they were actually on their hands and knees doing everything. So with the Efficient, you're standing in deep water and you're just using it as for like a floating table. So you're at 33 inches, which is the norm. Less trips up and down the beach. I mean, that's a good thing. And then you're able to fish and clean at the same time. So if fishing is slow, then you just turn around, clean your fish, and then keep fishing. So it's a quick process time. And then one of my colleagues, I presented this at my class this spring, and there is no carrying water. You don't have to carry water for this table. And all the research I did on the internet and at the local sporting goods stores, you had to carry water ahead to have water available to do that. And with the Efficient, you're standing in the water, so you don't have to carry it. And my colleague, he was just like going, how much time this is going to save me? I mean, I will not have to carry 5-gallon buckets up and down the beach. So he was pretty happy about that. And then lastly, you're coming off the beach with clean equipment and a clean product. So I think that's in itself is huge, because that's what I like about it is everything you're not coming off. You don't have to go back to your truck, you have to go back to your campsite with the grimy gear, and everything's taken care of it, and you're done it right there. So, and I developed a slogan for it too. It's called the Efficient. It's a simple design for easy use. So I got a prototype back there, so if you want to take a look at it later, I'll be here. Thank you.
Okay, that was pretty cool. Is there a place to put a beer or something like that? Is this on? Okay, we'll to the next person. So next to the podium, I'd like to bring Ms. Stephanie Plentovich, who's with the Alaska Energy Authority.
Thank you. So I'm the program manager for biomass with Alaska Energy Authority, and today I'm just a messenger. But I do have the honor to tell you about the Sustainable Energy Galena, Alaska project. This is a story about an innovative wood heating system in an Arctic environment, but more importantly, it's a story about collaboration, vision, and resilience. So Galena is a community, about 500 people. It's in central Alaska on the Yukon River. It's isolated. You can only fly in, and you can only get in by boat. Because of this remoteness and its proximity to Russia, in World War II, the military built an Air Force base. With the end of the Cold War, that base was targeted for basically being shut down. So as the military jobs were being phased out, Galena realized that they needed to change their focus. And they developed a vision that they were going to be an educational hub. 1997, the city of Galena opened a boarding school for vocational students through all of Alaska, and it was it's called the Galena Interior Learning Academy, GILA for short. It's located in the old base, the old buildings on the military base, and right now it's supporting about 220 students from around Alaska in the boarding school, but then another 3,500 distance learning students. This has become a major employer in Galena, and it's also become the heart and soul of the community. So I'm going to get technical now. I'm an engineer. I'm sorry. Galena historically is used about, the school has used about 230,000 gallons of diesel fuel to heat the school. Well, when the military base completely closed down in 2010, the military left about 1 million gallons of fuel to help the community transition to a different type of lifestyle. Galena realized that money or that fuel wasn't going to last for more than a few years, so they knew that they needed a change in how they were going to heat this building, heat all of these buildings. If they didn't have a different energy solution, they were going to have to come up with $1.3 million a year to heat the school. It's kind of big enough. It's a lot of money for a small community of 500 people. So enter Phil Kuntz. Phil is the project champion in Alaska, in Galena. He's also my favorite Alaskan. He was doing considerable research on different types of renewable energy options for the community, and he was leaning towards a wood heating system as a solution. Biomass, so that's any type of organic matter that can be used as a fuel. And Galena's blessed because they have just an abundant forest surrounding their community. So they're able to take trees, grind them up into little 1 to 2 inch chips, and then burn those to heat the school. So early 2010, Phil and the Loudoun tribe applied to Alaska Energy Authority's Renewable Energy Fund grant program and received a grant for a feasibility study. So while they were doing this feasibility study, Phil also spent an enormous amount of time educating himself and the community on the realities of operating a biomass system. Biomass is hard work. It's not like a simple fuel oil system where you fill up your tank and set your thermostat. You've got to harvest the wood. You've got to get it from the forest into the community. But when you do that, you're creating a local fuel, a very inexpensive local fuel, and you're creating local jobs. So with the positive results from the feasibility study, the biomass project was ready to move ahead, full steam ahead. But Mother Nature had other ideas. 2013 in May, ice jam in the Yukon River, I think most people remember that, started a flood, damaged over 90% of the homes in the community. I think Jack was very involved in the rebuild of that. One of the few areas that was protected from the flood was the Gila School, and that became the safe harbor during the flood and was also the home base for the rebuilding efforts. It slowed down the biomass project, but it confirmed that Gila was critical to the well-being of the community. I am just so proud of this project team. When you think about what they have done, I don't think they realize what they've done. Especially when you look at the impacts of the flood. So let me just tell you a couple of things about this project. Last December, they started up a large-scale wood heating system in a remote, isolated community. This is the first one in the world that's completely isolated. There are a few other chip systems around the world that are remote, but they're still on the road system. Now, when you're totally isolated, if you have a problem, you're not going to be trucking in any chips. You are committed to this system. From an Alaska standpoint, this is the largest biomass system in the state by a factor of two times the size of anything else that's been installed before. It's heating 14 buildings and displacing 230,000 gallons of fuel every year with a local resource. They also have an innovative business plan where the school district, the Loudoun Tribe, and the city of Galena created a nonprofit corporation called Sustainable Energy Galena, Alaska, that's managing the wood harvest. That wood harvest program has created six seasonal jobs, winter jobs when there aren't many jobs in the area, that has an annual payroll of $175,000. That's $175,000 that was going out with the barge paying oil companies. Now it's paying local operators to process a local fuel. So when I look back at this project, I see there's just some very clear reasons for Galena's success. And it's they learned to work together, and they leveraged people's strengths, and they learned that collaboration equals community resilience. And I can't think of a more important quality for a remote Alaska community that's going to be dealing with challenging issues in a changing Arctic environment. So my money's on Galena in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And now I'd like to bring to the podium Mr. Cameron Willingham, who's with Vertical Harvest Hydroponics.
All right, thank you guys, and thanks for having us here for lunch today. It's an honor. So 3 years ago, three of us, two business partners and I, set out to grow food in the Arctic, and it's been quite an adventure. There was no roadmap to do this. Quite frankly, none at all. So we set out to do this, and we thought we would take a unique approach rather than what people normally think of as farming, say growing in the soil or growing in a greenhouse. We went with this technique known as vertical farming, and you know, comically enough, I'm going to try and explain this without a photograph, even though that would greatly simplify the process. But vertical farming is, in essence, where we take a few pieces of technology, agriculture technology, that would be hydroponic growing techniques and environmental control systems using computers, as well as LED grow lights. And we stack these systems in a vertical configuration, that's row upon row of plants, each with its own set of lights, its own airflow management system. And we stack these vertically, and then we put them inside of 40-foot shipping containers. Again, a photograph would really, really be great here. But so we put these inside of shipping containers, which is the largest format that we can actually get on site into these remote communities, which, as we all know, are logistically challenged in a lot of ways. And so we've had to really innovate in this space. We've really had to come up with unique solutions, fully understanding that every community we work in is going to have a different set of issues, a different set of needs, a different set of logistical challenges. When we get these systems out, we can get them set up in just a matter of a few days and into production in about a week, and your first harvest will be coming in about 3 months, assuming everything goes well. Nothing ever goes 100% smoothly, so we need to be realistic sometimes. And each one of these systems can produce about 1,800 pieces of produce. That is a market-ready piece of lettuce or a saleable clamshell of basil. We're literally replacing about 12 items right now on grocery store shelves in a few communities here in Alaska, which is an honor. That's exciting. To be kicking California's ass at something, sorry about that guy. I didn't you get excited sometimes about lettuce, right? So we've gotten these projects out into a few communities. We're the first vertical farm above the Arctic Circle in the community of Kotzebue. That's been an exciting project. We had to fly the shipping container up there. We're also taking two systems, literally as we speak, out to a community called Dutch Harbor here in Alaska. We're excited about that project. And the one I want to talk about today that really has been closest to me is a project we did in Dillingham, working with a gentleman out there and his family. They're a Yupik family. They live off of their farm, subsistence fishing, hunting, trapping, and dog mushing. And they've taken on one of our systems, and they've integrated this system, this vertical farming system, into their way of life. And it's been a real learning process to see how they kind of think of this stuff. I mean, we see just technology. They see it as this extension of this cultural value that communities should be self-sufficient. You should be able to feed yourself. It's one of the most basic cultural values on Earth. And it's been really cool to see him apply this stuff. Oh, and I forgot to mention, he also just this year won Best Beer in Dillingham. He's an excellent brewer. So it's been exciting to see how people have used this technology and what they've done with it. And through this process of learning, we've also taken a lot of feedback from a lot of different people around the United States, Canada, and Alaska. And we've taken this feedback to heart. What we're doing now is we're going to expand the directions that this company is going to go. We're taking these same technologies, these same systems, and we're putting them into a unit that is maybe 2 times the size of this podium, maybe slightly larger, and we're going to try and get these into people's homes in the Arctic, people's restaurants, people's small business, so they can literally take that last mile of the food chain and remove it entirely. So we're pretty excited to see how people apply this and to see which direction they take it. And then in another direction, we've been really closely working with a Canadian company, and they're tied to the Canadian government. Their big tenet is job creation. That's really one of their big missions. And so we really did a lot of back and forth with them and arrived at this idea that rather than build a product in the U.S. and export it to Canada, because the whole goal is to reduce these imports over there, why don't we just take all of our designs, all of the lessons we learned, all the technology, everything down to the nut, bolt, washer, whatever, and why don't we just go over to Canada and show you how to build these things, teach you how to do this. Hopefully some of the lessons we've learned will sink in. And then they can have an entire farm food ecosystem, from building the vertical farming units to delivering them to staffing them to selling the produce to getting that produce into people's homes. So we're excited about that direction. We'll be over there next month kicking off the first build of 7. And I want to hear from you guys, anyone who's listening or anyone in this room, if you guys have some unique ideas or you see an opportunity to apply these technologies in a different way, we want to hear it. We're here to solve this problem, and we can't do it alone. So if you guys are interested, look us up on the internet, verticalharvesthydroponics.com. Thank you.
And our final speaker, before we have time for some questions from the audience, I'd like to bring to the podium Ms. Christina Woolston from Cantillion.
Thanks. Good afternoon. Thank you so much. I apologize for barging in the middle of a presentation. I was over at North by North, which is part of the Week of the Arctic, and it's been a fascinating and exciting week. And Cameron, your innovation, of course, was featured as part of the food component of North by North, and it's fascinating working in Kotzebue, where part of our fiber system will go. They're very excited about it. The words butter lettuce never existed in Bristol Bay when I was growing up there, but Brussels sprouts sure did, because they were hardy and they could grow there. So I ate a lot of salmon and Brussels sprouts, but on behalf of all the kids in Bristol Bay, if you could bring more butter lettuce instead of Brussels sprouts, that would be great. I'm with Quintillion, and Quintillion is an Anchorage-based company that is building the first subsea fiber optic cable system in and through the Arctic. We're a team of about 12 people. We're privately funded. We have a strategic investors in Alaska, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Chulista Native Corporation, and Aztec, which is a telephone co-op up on the North Slope. I have some brochures passing around, and there's also a sample of our fiber optic cable. Quintillion was founded in 2012 by Elizabeth Pierce, who's been with ACS for a number of years. She came to Alaska with the NORAD system. And we, you know, those of us that grew up in rural Alaska and work in Alaska, we understand the challenges to building infrastructure in a place like Alaska. It's important, it's also very challenging. Our system is designed, and if you have the brochure on your table, I think I brought enough for almost everybody. You can see the system is designed to be built in three phases. There were many companies that looked at this before, but really the way that they approached it was one giant fiber strung from Europe to Asia. And Quintillion was going to be the company that had the opportunity to bring the fiber into Alaska and into the United States. Well, when the project was funded in 2015, they selected Quintillion to be the company that would build and operate the system. So we're thrilled that it's an Alaska company that's doing this and that we will be the first to see the fruit of our labor of this fiber system. Phase one, which is anchored in Alaska, as I mentioned, is comprised of two initial components. One's the terrestrial part, and that's a land-based fiber that's built up the Dalton Highway between Fairbanks and Prudhoe Bay. That portion is complete and in commercial service as of last month, which is very exciting. The subsea portion, and it goes subsea or marine at Prudhoe Bay or Oliktuk Point, and then it goes west into Ukiavik, Barrow, Wainwright, Point Hope, Kotzebue, and Nome. We accomplished almost all of that build last summer. We had roughly 14 vessels in the water at any given time. We had five different cable splices being laid at a time. But wind, weather, whales, ice, lots of things happened in Alaska. And we have to come back this summer to do about 70 kilometers of installation in order to connect to the subsea cable, subsea communities that I mentioned. The system has the capacity to operate at about 30 terabits per second. And in our terms, that's roughly 2,500 high-definition movies downloaded in 1 second, which is great, but many other applications as well. The system has the ability to enable true telehealth. Our schools sometimes lack the connection to download even the statewide testing model that is required, and so our schools are not able to accomplish or to achieve basic required educational components. Our communities lack connections to e-banking, to e-commerce. One gentleman in Wainwright, one of the communities we're building into, said that it took him 36 hours to download Windows Anniversary Edition. Those are barriers, significant barriers to our communities for economics, education, health, and just being part of this global network. There are over 3 billion people that are using the internet every day, and that grows every day in terms of the number of users. And our communities, to a certain extent, are still using very limited bandwidth and speed. Our system will enable existing communication systems to operate better. We're a wholesaler, and so we build the infrastructure and we allow telecommunications providers to buy capacity on a wholesale basis to our communities. The neat piece about this is this will be the first system of its kind connecting Europe to Asia. It will be, when we're finished with it, who knows if it'll be the shortest system for the long term, but it'll be the shortest connection between Europe and Asia. It provides a critically diverse path out of the United States. We have 4 cable lines running out of Alaska, and they virtually go to the same place in the Pacific Northwest. That is not a physically or geographically diverse route. A geographically or physically diverse route is important if technology companies, if industry is going to invest in putting operations or innovative solutions to technology and in our state. We have the ability to be a tech corridor. You know, little Alaska in the northern part of our globe has the ability to be a point for telecommunications throughout the world. We are positioned geographically to be very close to the major economies of the world. And by connecting it by fiber, it allows us to be really at the epicenter of what's happening globally. The system is designed Phase two connects from Alaska to Asia into Japan, and phase three connects from Alaska heading east through Arctic Canada, through the Lower Northwest Passage, and onto Europe. We'll probably build that in two parts, phase 3A and 3B. The market is really driving this. Since we're a privately funded company, Zero public dollars, zero taxpayer dollars have gone into constructing this system, and we're very pleased about that. By being a wholesaler, we believe that introducing competition to many of these communities. I read something recently that over 113,000 Alaskans have a single provider in their community for telecommunications. That's a challenge because products, price, and services diversity really enables the very best options for our communities. Did my timer leave? I have to be over 5 minutes by now. There's no way. I think she maybe left the room. How am I doing? Am I okay? Okay. We're almost done with phase one. As I mentioned, we're in commercially into Prudhoe Bay and the North Slope. We'll be turning up service into the rural communities in Alaska later this year. Like I said, we have to complete the build in this summer into Prudhoe Bay, that one small segment. And then we're looking at other places in Alaska to bring fiber. This is not the end for us in Alaska. We are excited about new locations. I just can't announce them yet. It's important for the company that we both find and accomplish the technical and the financial feasibility for a build. And so until the time that we can determine both of those, we hold off on making announcements. So that's my presentation. There's general contact information on the back, but you're certainly welcome to approach me personally. And I'm here in Anchorage. And I would say that I'm glad to see all of these students here. We adults are a little slow in some of the ways to look at the world, and I have to say that our son Noah, who was 9 at the time that I was really starting to work on this project, I was trying to explain the technology to him and what it does and what it enables, and I was explaining it to him, and I said, it's glass, but there's light waves passing through it, and I said it's really, really fast, and he said, it's the speed of light, Mom. And I said, oh, you're right. That is very, very fast. So anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we heard a lot of different great projects, as well as from a gentleman from Innovation Norway and Ambassador Kåre Aas. So we're going to try to do this Q&A a little bit differently. Like usual, please raise your hand if you have a question for anybody here on the panel. If you could just state who your question is for, I'm going to stand in the front and I will hand the microphone to that person to answer your question. So just raise your hand and say who your question is for, and I will hand the microphone to that person.
Can I go?
Yeah.
Okay. My question is for Ms. Plintovich. How do we know that there's enough wood to sustainably support this wood heating system?
Good question. So when we do any biomass projects in the state of Alaska, we require a harvest analysis and an inventory analysis that looks at over the next 100 years or even for basically forever, is there going to be enough wood that is growing around a community that can supply that project forever. So with the Galena project, we used a number of 20,000 tons of wood a year, and we found that within the Galena area, we could very easily supply 20,000 tons per year for forever. Well, the Galena project's only using 700 to 1,000 tons per year, so there's enough wood in the Galena area for 10 to 20 of these projects. So, but the last thing we want to do on a biomass project is not have a sustainable harvest and basically destroy our forests. That would just destroy biomass in the state of Alaska. So very important that every project has an inventory analysis and a harvest plan.
I have questions actually for everybody. talking of biomass, Galena is on the Yukon. How about using fish as an additional biomass?
That is one thing that we're very, very interested in. So the large fish processors in Alaska, so down in Unalaska Dutch Harbor, they actually use their fish waste and make biodiesel. Well, where we need a solution, we need an innovation, so anyone that's got ideas, it's for the small to medium processors, where they really don't have enough quantity of materials to support the capital investment to make biodiesel. So we're looking at, we did a few studies where we said, can we take 5 or 10 small processors and bring all the fish guts to one place and make biodiesel? And that didn't work out financially yet. We're also looking is, can we use anaerobic digestion? Can we cook the fish and take the methane and burn it for heating fuel? So we're trying to find a demonstration project right now with a small to medium processor that we could prove that technology.
I had a question of Christina. It looks like from your phase two map here, you're zipping past about 2 million potential customers in the Russian Far East. I wonder if there's been any talk about trying to connect with Russia.
Thanks, David. The system internationally, at this point right now, no. I think we have some things to overcome first before we tackle that market. So the system is designed, there's three pairs in our international system. So there'll be an express route between Europe and Asia, and then the other pairs will be shared. And the technology is that you have one strand this way and one strand this way. So they're built in pairs, kind of like the arc. And so at this point, no. However, there is an incredible opportunity for Alaska. The island of Gamble is the perfect location for an international meet-me point for subsea telecom cables, fiber optic cables, excuse me. And so we do see that as a real opportunity in the future for Alaska to be the, you know, the housing of those international telecom cables. There's a project that's looked at in the northern part of the other route of the Northwest Passage. And they're not funded, they don't necessarily have a design yet, but this is the way of the future in terms of connecting the globe. There is a lot of fiber optic cables out there, but many of them pass through sensitive areas of the world, the Middle East. There are some areas that are very susceptible to sabotage. Building in the Arctic provides a natural layer of protection because not a lot of people are going to dive in the Arctic, dig up our cable 4 meters deep and try to sabotage it. Just won't happen. But this does provide for opportunities to connect other areas. And I know Russia is they are incredibly aggressive, both from their Arctic fleet, from their ports, their military, and of course telecommunications is part of that expansion. So we can foresee a conversation in the future, probably not on our system, but maybe somebody else's. But I can't say for sure that we wouldn't. My lawyers tell me that I can't say definitively really anything.
Thank you. Question for the ambassador. Norway has been a leader in technology related to oil and gas development and technology related to renewable energy development and deployment throughout Norway. Can you reflect a little bit on that? And what lessons should we draw from that in Alaska? And what opportunities do you see in our part of the Arctic?
I would say that in general, I think there are huge opportunities for strengthening the cooperation between Alaska and Norway in many, many areas. And that was also why I said that that the increased visits by policymakers in the United States and from the Congress to Norway is really to, as I see it, is really that they want to learn about what Norway has done within the energy sector. And I think that there has never been a very strong debate in Norway regarding to our oil and gas extraction. And that is why, because we have managed, I would say, to integrate all the stakeholders with views on that issue into the same decision-making process, which means that, for example, environmental organizations, they have been part of the process, enterprises, oil companies, and private citizens who have an opinion on what we have been doing in gradually moving to the north, has been part of that dialogue. And so even though there has been not a sort of a 100% consensus about going north with our oil and gas industry, I would say that the national consensus is broader than in many, many other places. And I also think that has to do with, in a way, with the political culture in Norway, where there always, I would say, has been this objective of trying to reach national a national consensus on major issues. So I think that that even though the climate conditions are different in Alaska than in the Arctic parts of Norway, I still think that there are good opportunities to strengthen that dialogue between companies operating here in Alaska or in Norway, and that is also, I think, that when, for example, Senator Murkowski and the Secretary of Interior, when they travel to Norway, and they will be there in the 26th of May, the one project that they will be visiting is outside the coast of the northern parts of Norway, and the city is Hammerfest, and that is really to see what we have achieved and what they can learn from that. And I would encourage both Norwegian but also those companies and Americans working on this in this field, really also to strengthen the cooperation even further than what has been the case until now. Let me also say that I have been working on Arctic issues for since the beginning of 2000. And when I started out, the interest for Arctic was very, very, there was not very much interest on Arctic issues in Europe or in the United States or other parts. But I must say that I have been impressed, I would say, what has happened the last 15 to 16 years on focusing on Arctic issues. And I think that's good in itself. Thank you.
Okay, and if we have no more questions, I want to thank everyone for coming. Oh, we have another question. Sorry.
Thank you. I just thought of it. I'm even kind of formulating the thought, so I hope you'll bear with me. My name's Leslie Ishii. I'm actually from Los Angeles, and I work in the arts and culture sector. I just came from Fairbanks with the Arctic Interchange Conference pretty much as a cultural observer. And it occurs to me in hearing all this innovative work going on with each of you, to what extent do you work with the Arctic Council and their task force and the research that's coming out around potential regulation? It's interesting to hear it from your end, many of you from the business sector. How much autonomy do you have? And as I'm learning what an incredible dynamic of consensus the Arctic Council has, how much autonomy do you exercise? Or how much do you work with what is coming, the information coming out of the council, and how they're developing consensus to move forward peaceably around sustainability and for the benefit of all to thrive? I'm sure there's a kind of an interesting dynamic there.
And who was the question for again?
For any of the panelists.
Okay. Would anyone like to talk about the cooperation between the Arctic countries? Okay.
Great question. It's been a terrific week in Fairbanks as well. I sit on the Arctic Economic Council's Telecommunications Task Force in the Arctic, and we released earlier this year our findings and our recommendations for a more comprehensive approach to broadband in the Arctic, and what does broadband mean. And we realize that not every community will get fiber, but how do we deploy solutions that are creative and can enable broadband in the Arctic. So from my perspective, it's been a great process to be included in that, to be part of the solution. The Arctic Council just yesterday, so we're the business side of the Arctic Council, a conglomeration of businesses, and they just released their telecommunications task force recommendations yesterday, and I haven't had the chance to read it, but from our industry, very inclusive, very comprehensive approach to working together.
And we don't work directly with them, but we follow them very closely, and they also follow our work very closely. We're part of the University of the Arctic, and we have collaborations and exchanges with others that are in the building science community throughout the circumpolar north. Every 2 years, we have a circumpolar conference on sustainable northern shelter, and that varies. We've been in Alta, Norway, we've been in Sisimiut, Greenland, we've been in Yellowknife, and then here in Alaska as well.
Yeah, being in agriculture, we're not working directly with the council, but we primarily work with other U.S. agriculture agencies and Canadian ones. But we would like to engage more with what the Arctic Council's been doing.
I have a question for Holly. How would the tattoos, how would they heal the community?
How would the tattoos heal the community?
Wonderful question, thank you. I could stand. With Native communities, we obviously have a lot. We've been separated from our families, for instance, with the boarding school situation and many different things that are hard on our communities. And what I think the tattooing, one of many, many things that's going on in Alaska, is doing is bringing people together and creating community. Here in Anchorage, here in the village. I think it's healing in that way, creating community, finding identity, celebrating your culture. Thank you so much for your question.
So I was wondering, like, through the vertical growing system, could you grow other plants like flowers or trees? Well, with supports for the trees.
Yeah, you can actually grow pretty much anything if it'll fit into one of these systems. I can't promise you'll grow it profitably. You may end up with a $200 mango, but we could probably figure it out.
And for we can give a big round of applause to all of our speakers.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing from a number of innovators about Arctic projects underway here in Alaska and abroad in an event titled, How Cool Is That? Innovation in the Arctic. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Hilton Hotel on May 12th. I'm your host and producer for today's program, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.